Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. I'm Kylie Colwell.
This is Kate Carter.
And today I want to jump right in,
Oh.
take a page out of Kate's book.
Okay, no preface. Go ahead, girl.
So, I have a case that reminds me a lot of the Long Island serial killer. So, let me know what you think.
Okay.
The story begins with the lone missing persons detective in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And yes, you heard that right. There is the most populous city in New Mexico with over 500,000 residents, has only one missing person detective, and her name is Ida Lopez.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and stop you there. What? The amount of people I feel like are missing in Albuquerque is too much, too many.
There's a lot.
And
And
maybe that's because there's only one detective.
yes, and we love her. So around 2005, Ida began to notice that there were a large number of Hispanic sex workers going missing in the area. All of these women were well known to authorities as sex workers and/or involved in the drug scene, but they hadn't been seen in a while, and some of them had been reported missing recently. Ida interviewed more than 200 sex workers and was able to compile a list of 19 women and teens who vanished from Albuquerque from 2003 to 2006. She took this information to her superiors on multiple occasions, seeking to form a task force to look into the matter further. Each time Ida brought this up, it was turned down. Sex work and being involved with drugs was a high-risk lifestyle, especially if these women didn't have a permanent address. Them being missing wasn't a big deal. They could be anywhere. Ida knew in her heart that something else was at play, and unfortunately for her and everyone in the town, she was right. On February 2nd, 2009, Christine Ross was walking her dog Ruka out on the West Mesa near her home when Ruka found a bone. Usually, this wouldn't be a big deal. There's animal bones everywhere out in the desert, but this is a true crime podcast. Christine thought the bone was a bit large and sent a picture of it to her sister, who was a nurse. Her sister was like, "Oh, I'm pretty sure that's a human femur. You should call the police." Investigators quickly ascended to the area, which was in what is called an arroyo bank, which is like a dry creek bed in the desert. They started digging where the femur was found and found a whole skeleton. Only inches away was another complete skeleton. Beside that one, another, and another. After 3 months of digging, around 92 acres, 11 skeletons were found, and the perpetrator was deemed the West Mesa Bone Collector.
Okay, I was wondering where you were going with this. I know the name. I know the name. I don't know any details of the story or anything, but I know the name. So this will be good. 11 bodies. I'm gonna go ahead and say there's more than that.
You're definitely going to need your little detective hat for this one.
Ooh, yay. Yay.
So it took almost 2 years to identify all 11 skeletons found. All were women between the ages of 15 and 32. All but one was Hispanic. And all but one was involved with drugs and or sex work. And wouldn't you know it, 10 of the girls on Detective Ida's list were women found buried in the West Mesa.
Wow, what are the odds?
So I'm going to go through a bit about each of the victims, going in order of when these women were last seen. 26-year-old Victoria Chavez was the first victim to be reported missing. She was also the first victim to be positively identified. Victoria was last seen on June 5th, 2003, and reported missing a year later by her mother. Couldn't find much about Victoria other than the fact that she was a sex worker and used drugs. The second girl reported missing was 22-year-old Monica Candelaria, who was a mom to a young son. Monica's family reported her missing 2 weeks after last seeing her and were told by police she probably ran away, and they never looked into her case.
I'm not surprised about that. To be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if most of these women. Well, that's a big thing down in the South, especially like in any states on the border. We know for a fact. I mean, it's indigenous women in particular, or people, indigenous people in general, Latina, Spanish, whatever. They all go missing, or lots go missing, and then it's never reported. It's never looked into. They never find them. I mean, even not even down there, but like Alaska isn't like, I feel like I've seen a million documentaries on people that have just gone missing and it's never even, the police don't blink an eye.
No, it's
It's
like
so normal.
hundreds of Indigenous women in Canada, even too.
Oh,
Nothing.
yeah.
Next was Doreen Marquez. She was 24 when she was last seen dropping her two children off at their school on October 10th, 2003. Doreen had a pretty seemingly normal life up until her boyfriend had been sent to prison, causing a mental health decline, which led to drug use. Doreen was known to disappear for a few days at a time. Eventually, her disappearances got longer and longer, and sometimes she was unreachable for months. Because of this, Doreen was not reported missing to police until a year later. One of the youngest victims, and also the only Black victim, and the only victim not from New Mexico, was 15-year-old Solania Edwards. Solania had a rough life growing up. Her parents and her brother were in and out of prison her entire life. Shortly before her disappearance, she was living in a group home for victims of abuse and neglect in Lawton, Oklahoma, which she ran away from. There was a rumor she headed to Texas, where her mom was staying, but then she was also seen associating with prostitutes in Aurora, Colorado, when she was living at the Ranger Motel. So get this. Solania was reported missing in 2003 from the group home. In July of 2004, she was arrested in Colorado for solicitation and then let go. She's 15, a minor.
15, a baby.
A baby, arrested for solicitation, and she's on the missing children's database.
Somebody messed up.
Big time. 28-year-old Veronica Romero was reported missing on Valentine's Day 2004 after being seen getting into a white pickup truck in downtown Albuquerque and not returning. Her family reported her missing and started searching on their own because, once again, police did not want to help find the mother of five. The last time Virginia Cloven's family heard from the 24-year-old was on April 23, 2004, when she called her dad to say she was getting married. Virginia, like many of the others, struggled with drugs and turned to sex work. So there was one victim that had no known involvement with either drugs or sex work, and that was 15-year-old Jamie Barilla. She was last seen in April of 2004, leaving a family gathering with her cousin. Her cousin, 27-year-old Evelyn Salazar, was also one of the victims found. She did have a history of drug use and sex work, but had recently turned things around. Julie Nieto was 24 when she was last seen on July 15th, 2004, visiting her grandpa, and was reported missing shortly after. She was a mom to one son, and unfortunately, her sister Valerie overdosed 2 years after her disappearance. Cinnamon Elks was last seen in August of 2004 and reported missing by her mom after she failed to call for her birthday, which, despite bouncing around, she never missed. Cinnamon was 32 and a mother of two who were in the custody of her mom. The last victim was 22-year-old Michelle Valdez. She was a mom of two and was last seen in September of 2004. During Michelle's autopsy, it was discovered that at the time of her death, she was 4 months pregnant. So the news of 11 women and teen girls being found buried in the desert obviously sent shockwaves through the community. In the media and the people kind of deemed the case the West Mesa Bone Collector. The Albuquerque Police Department, however, calls it 118th Street Homicides, a nod to the location at Dennis Chavez Boulevard and 118th Street.
No, that's too, that, no. Don't like that name.
I get you don't want to call them the West Mesa Bone Collector because it's a brutal name.
It's a pretty badass name, though. I'm not going to lie. Like, that's like a bone collector is nuts.
Yeah, that's like a villain in a superhero movie or something.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So like I said earlier, the burial site was in a dry creek bed, which is in a desolate area for a very long time. However, in 2006, the area started being developed for a new neighborhood, and the land surrounding the site was flattened to prepare for it. In 2008, as we know, there was a housing bubble crisis and development stopped. Because the area had been flattened, it changed the course of water flow and the area became flooded. The developer of the property built a retaining wall to channel the water to a new retention pond, and over the course of time, the bones in the burial site came to the surface. All these little things had to happen in order for these bones to come up. Investigators figure all this out and were like, okay, all of these women went missing and were likely buried there before 2006 when the development started. So they comb through satellite images of the area and find some more interesting tidbits. Between 2003 and 2005, there were intermittent tire marks leading to disturbed patches in the soil where the bodies had been located. The images also show that the final burial occurred in 2005, shortly before development started. So while investigators are searching and surveying the ground, let's head into the medical examiner's office. Unfortunately, the bodies were too decomposed to be for certain on the cause of death. Strangulation is the front runner, as there were no signs of blunt force trauma, like broken bones, and no bullet holes. The official cause of death was listed as homicidal violence. All of the bodies had been wrapped in plastic. None had any clothing, jewelry, or personal items with them. So whoever did this was careful. The Albuquerque police quickly realized they were dealing with a skilled killer and assembled a team of 40 investigators. They also called in the FBI to assist. So you will see throughout this story, the investigators, they're pretty tight-lipped. They're not releasing shit. They let a couple things slide, but not much. Only 5 months after finding the burial site, and before all the victims had even been identified, the investigators did announce they already had 5 persons of interest.
Okay.
They didn't give out the names.
Of course.
But we do learn over the course of the years, 3 of them. And if you caught it, I said persons of interest because to this day, no one person has been named as an official suspect.
Wonderful. Love that. So excited for the rest of the story, Kylie.
So the first name that came up was quickly brushed aside. It was Fred Reynolds, a local pimp who was pretty well acquainted with most of the women found. It is rumored, just a rumor, that Fred had photos of the missing women. I mean, if he was a pimp, if he was their pimp, I don't know.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's got to be a reason that he was knocked out, though, you know?
Yeah, and Fred passed away like a month before the bodies were found.
Of course he did.
Another name that comes up is serial killer Scott Kimball. His story is wild, honestly deserves an entire episode, but for the time's sake, I'll give you a little summary. Mr. Scott Kimball is a fraudster, a con man, and a career criminal. He was eventually arrested by the FBI for check fraud and somehow convinced them to allow him to be an informant in exchange for dropping the charges. While acting as an informant, Scott became a serial killer. His first murder was a woman named Leanne Emery, the girlfriend of a former cellmate of his and that he was trying to help escape. Scott and Leanne were on a road trip to break this guy out of prison when Scott asked Leanne to go for a hike. On this hike, he shot Leanne in the head. Her body was found 6 years later near the Colorado and Utah border. In 2003, Scott led a similar expedition with the girlfriend of another inmate to kill a witness. Her name was Jennifer Markham. Her car was found abandoned at the Denver airport. Jennifer has not been located, but Scott told the story that someone else had killed her, but he had just removed her breast implants and her IUD so she couldn't be identified. But he didn't kill her.
Okay.
That same year, Scott fell in love with a woman named Lori McLeod, and shortly into their relationship, Lori's daughter Casey went missing while Scott was allegedly out of town on a hunting trip. Casey's boyfriend later came forward and said that he saw Scott picking her up at the motel she was staying at. While Casey was missing, Lori and Scott got married and went camping for their honeymoon in Kremling, Colorado. And Casey's body was found near this camping site years later. 1 year later, Scott attempted to kill his own son by dropping a grate on him. He then drove him to the hospital, and in the process, he pushed his own son out of the car. After 2 weeks of being in a coma, his son, Justin, told him investigators what had happened, but the neurosurgeon said his injuries probably affected his memory, so the cops didn't charge Scott.
Love that. Love it. Scott's crazy.
He gets crazier. After all this, Scott's uncle Terry comes to help with the kids because Justin just got out of the hospital. They have another son. Then Terry goes missing. Uncle Terry. His body was found in 2009, and all the money that was stolen from his account was traced back to Scott, who was finally arrested and charged with 4 murders. He was sentenced to 70 years in prison, and little fun fact, while he was an informant, he gave the FBI 0 information. None of it was true.
I don't understand. I know his story a little bit, but I don't understand how he ever became an informant. Like, it made no sense to me.
Guess can manipulate the FBI.
That's nuts.
So Scott's name only came up in this case because he told reporters that he was being investigated for the murders. But this was never confirmed by authorities. The next guy was confirmed to be looked into. So on December 9th, 2010, the Albuquerque police released photos of 6 unidentified women stating they may be linked to the West Mesa women. So if you're watching on YouTube, quick warning, the photos of the women that are going to pop up, They appear to be unconscious in the photos.
Yeah, that middle one's dead for sure. If the others aren't, she's for sure dead. Her body is yellow.
They look dead.
Yes.
So the police at the time didn't say how they got these photos or where they came from. They just released them asking for more information.
I can't believe they've released those.
I know. And then the next day they released a photo of one more woman. And this woman was later identified by her family members who confirmed she had died of natural causes several years before. 3 days later, the police announced that two more of the women had been identified as alive, but they could have valuable information if they are located. What does that mean?
Wait, what? Two of the women that were identified are alive.
Yes, but they hadn't been located. Because like when I first read that, I was like, okay, are these other missing sex workers?
Right.
But it seems like the police don't even know their names.
They don't know who they are.
No. So where these photos came from, we didn't really know, but we do find out. In August of 2010, investigators searched the property of Ron Irwin in Joplin, Missouri. Ron was a photographer who regularly attended the New Mexico State Fair, which is down the street from the burial site. No idea how they landed on Ron, but during these searches, tens of thousands of photos were confiscated, and that's where those photos came from. Investigators didn't say why, but they did clear Ron Irwin.
How did he have these photos, but then he was cleared?
I don't know.
That's weird.
Like, I couldn't tell if he was taking photos of women sleeping or he's got some weird kink thing. I don't know. These next two guys, I think, are stronger suspects, though. Okay. And we have a lot more information on them. So Lorenzo Montoya is a name that comes up the most in theories and suspects. And he was a printer at a local print shop. He also lived less than 3 miles from the burial site in a trailer park. In 1999, Lorenzo was arrested for sexually assaulting and strangling a sex worker. He was arrested again in 2004 for a very similar incident. And both of these charges had been dropped.
Love that. How do you strangle and try to kill somebody and then have the charges dropped? Like, even if you said something along the lines of like self-defense, that don't make sense to me.
This whole story, it's frustrating. One, that it's unsolved. Two, okay, the women are going missing. They're being reported as missing. That's not being investigated. You have all these creeps with prior charge or arrest, no charges.
Yep.
If any of this was looked into, maybe none of it would have happened.
Yeah. Yep. Story of our lives.
So according to Lorenzo's one-time girlfriend, he had threatened to kill her and bury her in lime, which, if you didn't know, is a common chemical used in graves to cover the smell of decomposition. Lorenzo's co-workers also told authorities that he had talked about killing women and burying them on the West Mesa prior to the discovery of the burial site. If you hear your coworker say that, like even before anyone finds anything, I would tell someone then.
I would tell, especially just that specific.
Very. So Lorenzo was on investigators' radar. They knew of this guy from his prior arrest. They take a look again at those satellite images of the site, and wouldn't you know it? In one of the images taken in 2006, one of the dirt trails from the burial site led straight to the trailer park Lorenzo was living in.
That's nuts. First of all, I'd love that they could see that, but good job, I guess.
Unfortunately for this investigation, Lorenzo Montoya died in December of 2006.
She died.
How he died was nuts, by the way. On the 19th, Lorenzo had convinced 19-year-old Sharika Hill to come over and dance for him. She was a sex worker, and they had met in a chat room. When Sharika's boyfriend showed up to take her home from the trailer, he walked up to Lorenzo putting Sharika's tied-up dead body in his trunk. Frederick, the boyfriend, shot Lorenzo to death as soon as he saw what was going on.
So Lorenzo was a killer.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a statement. But like, can you imagine, first of all, you know your girl's out there sex working and stuff and you got to go pick her up later. Like, that's how you guys are paying the bills. To each their own, whatever. As a man, shocked. Pulling up and seeing her body going into the back. Yeah, can't even. I mean, I would have killed him too, but that's nuts.
Insane. Luckily for Frederick, which I agree with, police refused to arrest him or charge him for Lorenzo's murder.
Yeah.
Authorities did say that Sharika's death and attempted concealment was so brutal that it could not possibly be the first time Lorenzo did this.
Oh.
They did search Lorenzo's trailer and years later released more information about what they had found. In the trailer, authorities found a home recording. Only a portion of this has been released publicly. The first part of the video, which has not been released, has been said to show Lorenzo having sex with an unidentified and possibly deceased woman. The camera then pans to the wall for about 30 seconds. And I'm going to play the second part for you. It doesn't show anything other than the wall. Well, let me know what you hear.
Okay, so I need the whole video. I want to see it. I want to watch it. I want to understand. Oh, yeah. Well, not the sex with the dead person kind of. I just want to know what's happening in the entire video. What I just saw was a blank wall, obviously. What I heard was duct tapes and garbage bags.
That is exactly what I thought.
Yeah, 100%.
Very creepy to listen to. Even though you can't see anything, just hearing it is fucking creepy.
Yeah, like you know what's going on.
Police did later release a screenshot of the woman in the video and of another woman in a separate video in hopes they could be identified and located. And to this day, neither woman has.
We need to investigate the notorious Wes Mesa murders today, releasing pictures of two women who could help them solve this case.
We try to keep things really tight-lipped, try to preserve the integrity of the investigation as much as possible, and it's just not leading us anywhere. So let's release some things and see if we can't generate the waters flowing again.
Police want you to take a good look at these two women. The photos of the women were found on a homemade sex tape belonging to Lorenzo Montoya. Police say these women could provide solid evidence connecting him or clearing him of the crime.
As if all this information isn't enough to really point fingers at Lorenzo, you might have already caught it, but the killings and burials stopped after his death. And there's a counterpoint to this. His death was around the same time the development of the area started. So if it wasn't him, the killer could have found a new burial site knowing that this wasn't going to be a peaceful rural area for much longer. And there are a bunch of other missing sex workers that weren't at the West Mesa burial site. So could there be another site? We have one last guy who is also a strong suspect, and luckily he is still alive and can be further investigated. His name is Joseph Blia, aka the mid-school rapist.
Oh.
He got this nickname because in the 80s, he would break into the homes of 13 to 15-year-old girls near McKinley Middle School and rape them. In one of these instances, DNA was found on the 8th grade victim. But get this, the DNA was not tested until 2010, 30 years later.
But they had it. They kept it. Okay. First of all, I'm shocked that they kept it because we know that shit goes missing literally within a day sometimes. And of course they didn't test it right away. This is one of those cases where it's just going to be like shit work.
The whole thing just shit work.
Yeah.
So the DNA came back to Joseph, who was well known to police because at that point he had 140 recorded law enforcement encounters. He exposed himself to sex workers. He tied them up without their consent. And one time, a cop found rope and electrical tape in the front seat of his car. After Joseph's arrest for the rape of the young girl in 2015, Joseph's DNA was also matched to a sample found on the inner waistband and belt of a murdered sex worker in Albuquerque. He has not been charged for this murder. In June of 2016, Joseph was sentenced to 90 years in prison for the rape of four victims. Now to our West Mesa victims. After Joseph's arrest for the rapes, police revealed that in one of the graves, they found a tree tag from a local nursery. Joseph was a landscaper, and he frequented this nursery quite a bit. This is just another, like, weird coincidence of the Long Island serial killer to me. Because remember, they found the victims in the burlap sacks from the nursery. And they're like, oh, it's the one guy that works at the nursery.
Yeah.
So like I said, those are the two guys that seem to be like the best suspects so far. But there are other theories floating around. A few years ago, the Albuquerque Police Department and FBI announced that an anonymous tip led them to a suspect from El Salvador. Zero more information was given. So don't know if this guy's in El Salvador, if he's from El Salvador, whatever. The police department also has floated around the idea of a sex trafficking ring. Albuquerque is a hotbed for sex trafficking, as is, I guess, every city in the world.
Yep.
Albuquerque sees its biggest uptick in sex trafficking during the annual state fair in September of each year. Last year, during the fair, 91 women were rescued.
Do you think if I had that information, I would ever step foot on the Albuquerque like state fair? That's crazy.
Like, I had heard, like, the Super Bowl.
Right.
NBA Finals, like, that's when all the girls are trafficked in. The state fair.
I'm not going to lie. It's a good place.
We do love a fair.
We do love a fair. Could I see trafficking being done there? Absolutely. 100%. You would. It's too crowded. There's too many people. It's too big, you know?
Well, I don't understand. It's like, how many dudes are going to the fair to get their rocks off?
Probably a lot.
Men are just horny.
Dude, it's just...
Another theory that comes up, which has not been investigated by police, is that there is a police officer or multiple police officers involved. This theory stems from an alleged statement made by victim Cinnamon Elks, who allegedly told a friend shortly before she disappeared that there was, quote, a cop decapitating sex workers and burying them on the West Mesa, end quote.
Uh-huh. That's really specific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not to like point fingers, but 100% probably believe that. Yeah. Is it our specific person? Who knows? But I wouldn't doubt that that's probably also a thing that's happened or is happening.
There has been a lot of instances of Albuquerque police officers hiring or doing illegal things with sex workers on the clock.
Yeah. Good cops and bad cops, man.
Fun fact, 50 Cent and Mel Gibson starred in a movie called Boneyard, inspired by this case.
Oh.
And in the movie, apparently the prime suspect was a police officer. The chief of the department, of course, did not appreciate this. Yeah, and stated, at no point has an officer been a suspect. Can we trust them?
Nope.
No.
Never.
Then there's this private investigator who was hired to find Nina Herron. He claims to have gotten emails and voicemails from someone claiming to be the perpetrator.
Local private investigator receives a chilling message from a man who claims he is the West Mesa killer.
Action 7 News reporter Will Carr listened to that voicemail and joins us now with the story.
Doug and Shelley, to this day, the West Mesa killer has never been identified or arrested. And while the murderer may still be on the streets, one local private investigator says he continues to get messages from a man who has claimed that he killed all of the women and the fetus and buried them in the desert. And the investigator just received another call last week and agreed to play that for us today.
You know who I am.
An anonymous caller left those words on the answering machine at the Final Notice Investigative Services Group several days ago.
He stated, "You know who I am." And I said, bingo.
Dr. George Walker Sr. says he immediately recognized the voice. He says the same man sent him an email and left several messages last year claiming to be the West Mesa killer. At the time, Walker was investigating the disappearance of Nina Herron, a woman who police once thought might be a West Mesa victim. She did not end up being one of the 11 women found in the desert, but to this day, Herron remains missing.
I know Nina. I know who killed her.
And so now he's trying to taunt Final Notice Investigative Services Group by telling us that he got Nina too.
Walker says he has already contacted the police department and made them aware of the message.
It only takes one tip for us to solve this case.
That's why Officer Nadine Hamby says they'll take a hard look at the latest message, just like they did last year with the email and phone calls. She says they exhausted every avenue with those messages and plan to do the same with the latest call from a man who claims to have intimate knowledge of Nina Herron's disappearance.
I know who killed her and I know who did it. And I know why. Okay, bye.
The police department tells us that they get leads anytime a story on the West Mesa murder mystery airs. They tell us that they check into every lead that they get. They also say they think that someone from out of town may be able to crack this case because many of the victims were transients. Shelley.
Walker's involvement in this case is not without controversy. He claims he's reached out to the families of West Mesa victims offering his help, but the families tell us he has never contacted any of them. If you have any information on the West Mesa mystery, call APD's hotline at 1-877-SOLVE-APD.
My favorite part was the, okay, bye, I know who did it. Okay, bye. How can you not trace a phone call?
And emails.
And emails. People, we've been doing this for 30 years now. 20 years, maybe. 30. Almost 30. Yeah.
Really, since emails came out, I feel like.
Yeah.
That's what makes me think it's not credible. He says he gave this information to the investigators. I'm sure they looked into it and they're like, nothing.
No. I feel like it's sometimes, it's pretty rare when shit like that happens that it ends up being the person, unless it's like really, really good, like the Zodiac Killer and shit like that. But then again, Zodiac Killer had duplicate people as well, you know, so.
Well, then like with him, he releases little messages like to the media or to police directly. Like this guy's calling a private investigator who's not even working the main case.
Yeah.
Weird.
It would be a good story if it was him. Or them or whatever, but
I mean, it could be, we don't know.
Yeah, I'm still leaning towards the second guy, to be honest.
The mid-school rapist or Lorenzo,
the rapist guy, was he ever found? He never, that we know of, was found for killing someone.
He has not been charged for any murders,
but he has for rapes.
Yes,
two go hand in hand to me, but I still, Lorenzo gives me vibes.
Yeah, the one thing that threw me off with Joseph is the rape cases are like middle school age girls.
Yeah.
Which is a different, you know, victim type. But then he has the little run-ins with the sex workers as well.
Yeah. But to kill only sex workers.
Yeah.
And not younger girls. I feel like, I don't want to say like younger girls would be easier, but if that's your, you know, your thing.
Yeah, it'd be weird to be like, okay, I'm only going to rape this type of victim and then I'm going to kill this type of victim.
Teach their own.
So if you remember earlier, I said there were 19 women and teens who had vanished from the Albuquerque area from 2003 to 2006. 8 of these women are still missing. And whether or not they're also a victim of the West Mesa Bone Collector is to be determined, but let's talk about them and hopefully raise awareness for their cases. The first woman listed is a bit out of the state range, and there may be another suspect, but I'm still going to talk about her. 20-year-old Darlene Trujillo was last seen on July 4th, 2001 after dropping her young son off at her mother's house, explaining that she was taking a short 2-day trip to Arizona with a man named Jorge. A few weeks later, Darlene was reported missing after she didn't come home. Jorge returned to Albuquerque a few weeks after this, but said they had never gone to Arizona. Jorge said they had gotten into a fight, Darlene had kicked him out of the car, she drove off, and he never saw her again. Jorge's last name is not known, and he is wanted for questioning, but after all these years, he has not been located. Darlene was Hispanic, 5'5", 130 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She had quite a few tattoos, including the name Chris on her left wrist, Fran on her right wrist, a red and green flower on her left hand, spider on her left middle finger, praying hands with the rosary on her right shoulder, two angels on her right leg, a flowering vine on the back of her neck, and red and green flowers on her left leg. Darlene was last seen wearing a black or white shirt and white pants, and she would now be 44. The next missing woman is Martha Lucher, who was last seen on September 3rd, 2003, visiting her mom and kids. 32-year-old Martha left with a friend and never returned. Martha is white, about 5'1", with natural brown hair that was dyed red at the time of her disappearance, and brown eyes. She has a scar near her left eye, tattoos of a rosary on her right wrist, the word pray on her right hand, and the name Ashley on her right ankle. She would now be 53. Anna Love Vigil was 20 when she was last seen on January 1st, 2005 and reported missing a few weeks later. She is 5'6" with dark blonde hair and blue eyes. On her right ankle was the name Paul tattooed and on her left ankle a flower. Anna would now be 40. Felipa Gonzalez was 22 when she was last seen on April 27, 2005, shortly after being released from jail. She is Hispanic, 5'4", with brown hair and brown eyes. Felipa has a beauty mark on her nose, tattoo of Winnie the Pooh on her back, and her name on her ankle, and she would now be 42. 21-year-old Nina Heron was last seen at her home in Albuquerque on May 14, 2005. She is 5'2", and has a scar on the right side of her head. She would now be 40 and may go by the nickname Jasmine. The youngest on the list is Jillian Henderson Ortiz, who was 19 at the time of last contact. Different sources have different dates. Even the official government sites have a different date, but it was sometime in January or February of 2006 when Jillian called her mom to say she was going to visit her brother in California. Jillian never arrived, and the police in New Mexico and in California would not accept a missing persons report of her until a year later. Wouldn't even put it on file.
Absolutely blows my mind. And it's so sad for the families that like constantly are pushing for that too, you know?
Insane. Jillian is white, about 5 foot tall, with blonde hair and blue eyes. She has a scar on her forearm and a tattoo of a man's name on her lower back. The name has not been released. Jillian would now be 39, and if she's still out there, she may use the last name Henderson or Ortiz rather than them hyphenated together. Next is Chantel Waits, who was last seen on March 15th, 2006. She was reported missing 7 months later by her grandfather, who was raising Chantel's four kids. Chantel is black, 5'7", with black hair and brown eyes. She is missing at least 7 teeth and has the word lady tattooed on her right leg. Chantel may go by her middle name, Monique, and she would now be 48. On June 13th, 2006, 24-year-old Vanessa Reed was last seen walking away from the motel she was living in after a fight with her sister. Vanessa is white, she has brown hair and brown eyes, and she is 5'4". She has the initial EC tattooed on her left ankle, the name Amy on her neck, and a heart on her right hand. She often gave different variations of her name, including Amy Vanessa, Vanessa Lojohn, or Vanessa Reed. She would now be 43. The last girl is Leah Peebles, who probably has the most media and true crime content coverage. Like, if you want to look into it, a bunch of episodes about Leah Peebles out there. Leah was 23 and had recently moved to Albuquerque for a fresh start after overcoming addiction. On May 22nd, 2006, she had gone on a date and later dropped her car off at a transmission shop for repairs in a bad area of town. The last time she was seen was walking away from the shop and crossing the street. Leah is white, 5'4", she has blue eyes and naturally brown hair, but it was often dyed different colors. She has scars from piercings on her right nostril, right upper ear, and left eyebrow. She also has tattoos of a scrolled flower on her upper back and a Celtic cross on her lower back. Leah would now be 42. Part of the reason why Leah's case is most covered, if you look up a picture of her, the first images you're going to find are blonde Texas beauty queen cheerleader.
Cheerleader. Yep.
Came from a nice family, had substance abuse issues as a teen. You know, she's not like the other missing girls that aren't getting any attention. Yeah.
Not surprised.
So if you have any information about any of these women, Darlene, Martha, Anna, Philippa, Nina, Jillian, Chantel, Vanessa, or Leah, you can call Crime Stoppers at 505-843-7867, or you can email investigator Ida Lopez at ilopez@cabq.gov. The case of the West Mesa bone collector has gone under the radar, and it feels like there isn't much urgency to solving it. Several journalists have published articles highlighting how the police and the local community just doesn't really care about it. The victims were prostitutes and or drug addicts. The burial site was in a rural area. There wasn't a real sense of danger for the common person. The families of these victims do care and have been pushing for more work to be done. In June of 2018, another dig was conducted in the area due to the pressure of these families. This was the first search done that used ground-penetrating radar. Bones were found, but they were later determined to have been ancient, probably from a native burial site. Another dig was conducted in 2021 with nothing. Officials said after this search, if there were any more victims out on the West Mesa, they would be under the houses that have been built there.
Can you imagine that? Like if somebody told me if I bought a house and then later on somebody's like, oh, by the way, there's potentially bodies under your house. I'd be like, what?
Scan the ground or we're digging this whole house up.
Absolutely. To the ground.
Oh, I accidentally built a house on like a native burial site. I'm like, that's bad juju. I'm leaving.
Absolutely. There's no way. Mm-mm.
No.
Even if someone said that, I'd be like, well, we have to move.
In June of 2020, the city did open a community park at the site dedicated to all 11 victims, with their names etched into the oval path. Each name has a corresponding bench and a tree picked out by their family members. We do have some new information that came out recently, a little tidbit. Hopefully this pans out. The Albuquerque Police Department has introduced a new bill, and if passed, it would allow police to enter the DNA of deceased suspects into CODIS. If you didn't know, a suspect dies before being officially charged, their DNA cannot be entered into the CODIS database and used to link to crimes. In New Mexico, inmates who were released from prison prior to 1996 are also not in CODIS because the use of it wasn't implemented until then. So this new law would allow for the DNA to be entered if approved by a judge on a case-by-case basis. So the police would have to argue that they think this is their guy. Do they just need to check the DNA? Which I think is a good thing. There's checks and balances. They're not entering everyone's DNA into the system. But the biggest hint we got from this bill was the fact that when talking about it, the police kept bringing up Lorenzo Montoya and the West Mesa murders. The one deceased suspect.
Right.
So is he their number one guy? Do they have DNA?
That kind of says yes, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then you have Joseph Blea, who's in prison. His DNA's in the system. They haven't explicitly crossed him off, but if they do have DNA somewhere on the site and it's not him.
Yeah.
So this bill is still working its way through the system. So we'll keep an eye out for that. The Albuquerque Police Department currently has a $100,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of what they call the 118th Street homicides. Over 1,500 tips have been submitted since 2009, but keep them coming. You can call the 118th Street Task Force at 877-765-8273. And that is the story of the West Mesa Bone Collector, which I feel like we'll have an answer soon. Call me hopeful.
I'm really thinking it's, what's its name?
Lorenzo.
Yeah.
Me too. It's got to be Lorenzo.
I've got vibes. At least some of them, you know, well, they're all in the same place, so it probably is, but... I feel like when you said he was putting the body into the trunk of his car, maybe he was about to drive her there.
Probably.
You know, who knows? He gives me bad vibes. Well, they all do, but he gives me bad vibes for this specific case.
Yeah. And the woman from the home video, she's not there. There's got to be a second sight, at least a second sight.
Yeah. Which is normal. That's crazy. No, I've heard of this case. I was curious though if you were going to come out and say that it had been solved.
I wish.
Yeah.
It feels like they're not doing shit, but I don't know if that's just because they're not talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's hard to not say they're not doing shit.
Yeah, I feel bad that there was only one detective. Albuquerque is such a big place. First of all, like huge. Also. There's so many missing people. I mean, like every place has missing people. Don't get me wrong, but Albuquerque's like a no. If you said, give me a list of like your top 10 places that you think the most people go missing in the U.S., Albuquerque would be on my top 10.
Yeah. High crime rate, a lot of sex workers.
In general.
A lot of drug use.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of desert.
Yeah. Land to store bodies.
Yeah.
Let's jump into overtime. I saw like maybe an hour, not even an hour before we hopped on to overtime, you added a new thing onto our overtime list that we have shared between all of us.
And that's the one you want to talk about?
It was a good one.
I put on the overtime list that the movie The Parent Trap starring Lindsay Lohan is insane.
Insane. Like if you actually think about The Parent Trap and the whole story itself. Nuts.
Like that's child abuse.
Absolutely.
Neglect. Okay.
Neglect to the finest.
Okay, quick summary. Just in case you've been living under a rock. Great movie. There's two twins. They're both played by Lindsay Lohan. They go to summer camp and then they realize, oh, they are twins. And their parents had gotten divorced. And in the divorce, each parent took a kid. One lives in England, one lives in America, right? And they're just raising them separately instead of sharing custody of both of them. But the dad, he has a new girlfriend, new hot young blonde, Meredith. And she's the villain of the story because she's like, this is insane.
But she also was a baby.
Yeah, she was like 20 years old.
Yeah, which in the movie, she don't look like it, but she a baby.
Because what brought this up is I saw a TikTok and they're like, no, Meredith Blake is in the right. Yes. If you find out that the man you're about to marry has twins he never brought up, and that he separated them.
Yeah. Weird. Red flags.
In the movie, they paint her out to be the villain because she wants to send the twins to like a boarding school in Switzerland. And the parents are like, no, that's crazy. You can't send them away. What the fuck have you been doing for the past 10 years of their life? Also, you're sending them to summer camp for 3 months.
People with money do that. That's a big thing down here too. Like the parents just send their kids away for summer camp for the whole summer.
I understand that. But then to say, oh, I'm not sending my kid to boarding school. You hadn't even seen the one kid in how long? I'm Team Meredith Blake on that movie.
Yeah. I loved that movie growing up.
I did too.
Oreos and peanut butter.
I don't think I've ever tried it.
What? Oh my God, Kylie, it's so good.
I'll have to try it.
It's so good. I also thought that Lindsay Lohan had a twin.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally convinced people that she had a twin as well. Like people be like, no, it's her. It's her. And I'm like, no, she has a sister. You guys, what are you talking about?
Yeah. There's no way they could have made that movie without a twin. Mm-mm. Also, we grew up with like Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen.
Oh, love them.
Oh, I watched every single one of their 100 movies.
Take them. Like, I want to watch them again.
I wonder if we can find them anywhere.
Full House. Love. Mary-Kate and Ashley Adventures. New York City. Didn't they go abroad at some point?
Lizzie McGuire. Lizzie McGuire in Spain. McGuire.
Oh my God. The Lizzie McGuire movie was life-changing.
The Cheetah Girls.
I love the Cheetah Girls.
Love the Cheetah Girls so much.
Yeah.
The jumpsuit with the cheetah print headband. I wanted that so bad.
I still want one.
God, should we get some? They had Juicy Couture sweatsuits at TJ Maxx the other day.
Why didn't you get some?
I didn't know if it was too much.
Mm-mm. I want a Juicy Couture sweatsuit to wear in the airport.
Okay, when we go on our...
Can we match? Kylie, can we match? We'll get Millie a little mini one too. So all three of us are matching in the airport.
Yes.
Or do we get all of us get a different color so we look like the Cheetah Girls?
Yes, that's what I think we have to do.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Holly, if you're listening to this, we're coming to visit you.
In our juicy sweatsuits.
And we'll send you one so that when you pick us up from the airport, you're also in one.
And we have to wear them all weekend. We can get multiple. Yep.
Yes. Otherwise, we'll just have to wash them.
We're going to go out to the bars in our juicy sweatsuits.
I'm also going to get one of those headbands.
The headbands are back in style. The little Gen Z girls are wearing headbands. They are.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God it's that and not like gaucho pants. I said, I was talking to someone at the gym this morning. Oh, she posted a date night picture yesterday with her boyfriend. And I told her, I was like, oh, I really liked your dress that you posted in that picture. And she goes, I've had that since middle school. And I looked at her and I was like, how old are you? And she said 24. And I was like, okay, that's not bad. But how have you had it? That's like at least 10 years. And she goes, yeah, like, I guess it just stayed in style. And I was like, you must have had really good style. Because in middle school, I was wearing gauchos. And she was like, what's a gaucho? And I was like, yeah.
See, my first thought was, you still fit in your dress from middle school?
Oh, if you saw her, then you would understand. She's one of the trainers.
Oh, okay.
She also is the type of person where she's hit almost 2,000 consecutive days of doing some type of run.
I'd rather kill myself.
Right? Put me in the West Mesa, man. Like, just knock me out. Yeah, over 2,000 days. Isn't that crazy? And it, like, she can do a mile, she can do 10 miles, whatever, but every single day for over 2,000 days, she has done some type of run. I was like, but what happens when you get sick? She goes, oh, I just hop on the treadmill.
Oh, that's so much easier. Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, you're a different breed. Like when I don't even have to be sick not to actually, you know what? This morning they made us do like two laps around the, well, we were supposed to keep doing more laps and I just went inside and cycled instead. Cause I was like, I can't do it. I hit my peak running when I was in like college and now I'm good. I don't need to run unless someone's chasing me.
Listen,
and in fact, I probably wouldn't run then either. I'd fight.
I'd have to, I can't fucking run.
Yeah. And I take it back. I wouldn't run if someone's coming after me. I would turn around and fight them. So just know that if you ever come after me, I'm fighting you.
If you ever come after me, I have my concealed carry license.
Yeah.
Putting that on the record.
Oh, go ahead. State that out there. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't. I have fists. That's about
don't
it.
Don't put that on the record.
Oh, yeah. Don't. Everybody take back what I just said. Oh, anyways. All right. Great story today, Kylie. Loved it. Keep us updated, though, on if there's any updates, like, in the future for this one, because I've always been interested in it.
Of course. And with that, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. If you want more information about this case or other cases we covered, you can check out overmydeadpod.com or follow us on social media at overmydeadpod. And I hear we'll have a special guest next week. So, bye.
Ooh, ooh. Bye.